Hello. This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 26th of October. The excerpts from the Hampshire Chronicle this week have been edited by David and Janet Farthing. And your readers today are Michael Wyard.
Hello.
Lynn Parker.
Hello.
Peter Lydiard.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Vara Williams. Now start with What's On. I have three theatrical events for you coming up in the next few weeks. The first is Winchester Operatic Society's production of The Merry Widow at the Theatre Royal from the 6th to the 10th of November, with a matinee on the 10th. For tickets, ring the Theatre Royal box office on 01962 840 440. That's 01962 840 440. Then that amazingly long-lived play, The Mousetrap, is actually coming to the Mayflower in the same week. That's, I think it's the 5th to the 10th of November. And if you want to go and see that, the Mayflower's box office number is 02380-711-811. 02380-711-811. And Salisbury Playhouse is performing The Spire, adapted from William Golding's book, which was inspired by Salisbury Cathedral. It runs from the 1st to the 24th of November. And the box office number for Salisbury Playhouse is 01722-320333. That's 01722-320333. Winchester Music Club is performing Britten's War Requiem in Winchester Cathedral on Thursday, the 15th of November at 7:30 p.m. Tickets can be obtained by ringing 01962 857 275. That's 01962 857275. And finally, the new Bond film is out. Skyfall will be on at the Everyman Cinema Winchester all next week, and at most other cinemas, I'm sure. For reservations at the Everyman, ring 0871 906 9060. That's 0871 906 9060. Lighting Up Time ends on Friday, the 26th of October at 7:49 a.m. and begins at 5:51 p.m. On Wednesday, the 31st of October, it ends at 6:57 a.m. and begins at 4:41 p.m. Remember, the clocks go back 1 hour on Sunday. And now we come to the Hampshire news, and the headlines this week are Hundreds Helped by City Streets Pastors, Colourful End to Autumn, and Bid to Solve Mystery of King Alfred's Final Resting Place. So we'll go over to Michael, please, for the story behind the first headline.
Hundreds Helped by City Streets Pastors. Street pastors have come to the aid of hundreds of people in need of help on the streets of Winchester, a charity has revealed. In its first year, the Winchester Street Pastor Scheme encountered more than 750 people, many said to be in considerable distress while out on the town late at night. Since its launch in July last year, the street pastors have been patrolling the city centre, offering support to those in need of it. Originally set up to patrol on Friday and Saturday nights, the initiative has been so successful that it now covers Thursdays too. Mark Hibbert Hingston, who leads the project in Winchester, said, "Compared to the 6 months before we started, there was a fall in violent crime." The pastors are a charitable organisation, and there are 250 such schemes elsewhere in Britain, including Southampton and Eastleigh. Pastors work to act as a calming influence, handing out blankets and water to those who appear overly drunk, even making phone calls and arranging taxis on their behalf. Between July 2011 and July 2012, there were 165 drunk people receiving some kind of assistance from pastors in Winchester, while the group attended 86 aggressive situations where they intervened to calm things down. "We have never been physically assaulted, although occasionally we are sworn at," Mr. Hibbert and Hingston said. Nearly 400 water bottles were handed out. 477 pairs of flip-flops were given to women whose high heels were proving a challenge. Some 70% of funding for the scheme comes from the church, but £6,000 of start-up money came from Winchester Improvement District, which goes on the acronym of BID. The BID now has made funds available for the pastor's second year, ensuring that the operation could be expanded. Chris Turner, the BID's executive director, said, "There was a real feeling that if we wanted to put an extra arm in to keeping the streets safe, then the pastors were a good way of doing it. Feedback from the hospital and the university is that it's been a huge success." A small grant also comes via the North Walls Police Station, and the pastors attend evening briefings there on Fridays and Saturdays. Julie Young, sector inspector for the City Centre Police, said, "They are our eyes and ears when they're out there. We've seen a big reduction in violent crime, and there is no doubt that the pastors and the work they do is part of that. They drive down antisocial behaviour purely by engaging with the individuals at the earliest opportunity." The Hampshire Chronicle reported last year that 11 local churches had pledged support to the scheme, but that to launch further patrols, more volunteers were needed. Mr. Hibbert Hingston said the response from local people wishing to volunteer had been impressive.
Colourful end to autumn. Hindus from across Hampshire came together on Sunday to celebrate the end of their autumn festival of Durga Puja. Hiltonbury Community Centre in Chandler's Ford resounded to live music, dancing, drama and to the flavours of Bengal. The festivities were organised by the Hampshire Puja and Cultural Association, which aims to promote diversity and community cohesion. The three-day event attracted people from all religions and cultures across the county. It celebrates self-awareness and self-control against the evils of life. There is a picture of Anushka Ghosh performing on stage.
Bid to solve mystery of King Alfred's final resting place. A Winchester church is hoping to solve the mystery of where King Alfred the Great is buried. The Reverend Cliff Bannister is preparing an application to exhume and study the bones believed to lie in an unmarked grave outside St Bartholomew's in Hyde. It is thought to hold the bones of the Saxon king after an earlier burial under Hyde Abbey was dug up in the 18th century. Mr. Bannister has been taking soundings locally to gauge support for the potentially controversial measure. He said feedback had been positive. "It's a mystery to solve. Why do we not know who's in there? Why is there no writing on the gravestone?" Mr. Bannister stressed, "The project will be done with dignity and respect. If there is the slightest possibility that they may belong to so distinguished and historically important a figure as Alfred the Great, or his son King Edward, or his wife Elswitha, then we feel a moral obligation to remedy this gap in recognition. The church must get permission from a diocesan advisory panel, consult national agencies such as English Heritage, before final approval from the diocesan chancellor, Judge Christopher Clark, QC. An application could be made next year, said Mr. Bannister. He added that the bones should get their proper recognition and memorial, whether they are Alfred's or not. Scientists will be eager to analyse the remains. There could be work with German scientists who have analysed the skeleton of Alfred's granddaughter in Magdeburg, Germany. Work is also set to take place on analysing the contents of the mortuary chests in Winchester Cathedral, where later Saxon kings are held. The Alfred grave was built in 1867 after an archaeological dig, and no one knows if the bones inside are royal or perhaps those of a Benedictine monk. This weekend is King Alfred weekend that marks the anniversary of his death in 899. Centred on St Bartholomew's Church, it includes an art exhibition called Ley Lines, a lecture by Dr. Ryan Lavelle, a historical activities day on Saturday, a concert, and then a parish communion on Sunday.
And that concludes the headlines. And now we come to the death notices. I'm afraid there are rather a lot. Brown. Annie Nora Brown, formerly of Alsford, in her 100th year. Butler. Mrs. Pat Butler, at home, aged 64. Collins. Joyce Collins, surrounded by her family, aged 85. Cook. Kathleen Cook, peacefully at home, aged 95. Dreyer. Molly Dreyer, at West Acre, Winchester, aged 92. Godfrey. Mary Godfrey, at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, aged 86. Grant. Frederick Grant, at home, aged 87. Haddon. Doris Haddon, aged 96. Hyde. Thomas Hyde died suddenly while on holiday in Fuerteventura. David. Joyce David, formerly of Hinton Ampner, aged 50. Lewenden. Albert Lewenden, at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital after a long illness. Lloyd. Philip Lloyd. Locke. Patrick Locke, CBE. Rickman. Patricia Rickman. Rowe. Norman Rowe, peacefully aged 90. Smart. Joan Smart, at Knights Grove Nursing Home, aged 94. Sollers. Ernest Bob Sollers, aged 94. And finally, Williams, Katrina Williams. And now we go over to Lynn for Christian comment.
One of my favourite stories is of an encounter between Trevor Huddleston and Desmond Tutu. Archbishop Tutu recalls the incident when he was about 9 and a white person showed respect towards his mother. "I didn't know it was Trevor Huddleston," he said, "but I saw this tall, white priest in a black cassock doff his hat to my mother, who was a domestic worker. He could not believe his eyes seeing a white man greet a black woman, and this seemingly small act affected him for the rest of his life. Remember, this was in apartheid South Africa, where the superiority of white people was enshrined in law. It was flowing from this that Desmond Tutu, after teaching, studied theology and followed Trevor Huddleston into the Anglican priesthood in 1960. It is important to remind ourselves of this at a time when there is so much about class in the media. Whether we are addicts of Downton Abbey, following the television documentaries on servants in Britain, or just listening to the current political debates, we cannot but be aware of how large a place class plays in the ways British people think and how we are perceived by each other. We recognise that there is both snobbery and reverse snobbery. Class war means a despising of the other, whether from worker to owner or owner to worker, from educated to those without work, or from those unemployed to those with higher education. The New Testament paints a picture of the church consisting of people from a wide range of backgrounds and yet failing often to get their relationships in the right perspective. St. James, in his letter, castigates the church for giving the best position to the wealthy, and especially the ostentatiously wealthy, who arrived in fine clothes. The church still gets it wrong from time to time, and I apologise for that, although we are struggling to improve. Desmond Tutu later said that he discovered Trevor Huddleston's behaviour was in line with his theology, that every person was of infinite value and of significance because they were created in the image of God. It was this that motivated Huddleston's struggle against injustice, and which Tutu then sought to follow and imitate. We should remember that respect for others is a fundamental Christian virtue. We need to see across the barriers which we erect, whether socially, racially, or educationally, and to recognise God's image in all whom we meet. Let us not be nostalgic about a society based on class, but rather remember the great value of respect. Terry E. Hemming.
Now we go to letters, and Peter, would you give us the first letter, please?
Yes, the first letter is from Peter Grant, and it's headed, Junction Job Will Just Be Cosmetic. Sir, the good news is that the Highways Agency intends to do a £400,000 cosmetic job on Junction 9 of the M3 at Winnall, Chronicle, October 11th. The bad news is that the inference that the same agency must think that it will cure the problems of this notorious bottleneck. Every motorist in Winchester knows that the problem will only be resolved by allowing northbound M3 traffic direct access onto the A34 and vice versa without having to use the Winnall roundabout. I'm not an expert in road design, but the words flyover and underpass spring to mind. That's from Peter Grant, Simmons Street, Winchester.
The next letter is on the same subject, and it's entitled, This Only Tinkers With the Problem, and it comes from Michael Warner, FCA, and it's Michael Warner and Company, who obviously has first-hand experience of joining at the Winnall Valley Road roundabout. Sir, good to read that some action is being taken to resolve the congestion at the M3A34 interchange. That was published in the Chronicle of October the 11th. However, £400,000 to be spent on better signing and lane designation sounds expensive and unlikely to do more than just tinker with the problem. The main issue is that traffic exiting from Winnall onto the interchange has only a short time to do so. At busy times, and because both the northbound and circulatory traffic lights are not set to leave a window of opportunity. Often, only a couple of vehicles can do so, and then, even then, it can be dangerous. It seems obvious that both sets of lights need to be set to hold back the oncoming traffic to allow up to 10 vehicles to join the interchange between light changes. The risk of a queue building at the lights leading to the M3 could be solved by a yellow hatched box. In my view, this is an obvious and cost-free first step, which is worth trialling. The reality, of course, is that a long-term solution can only be achieved by a substantial restructuring of the interchange. In the meantime, Winchester's reputation as a business centre is being damaged. That's from Michael Warner.
And the next letter is yet another thought on this Subject by Keith Webb, Quarry Road, St Giles's Hill, Winchester. Sir, I see something is at last to be done about the notorious road junction which causes so much misery to those who have to approach it from the Winnell Industrial Estate via Eastern Lane. I have been writing to you for well over 3 years now, suggesting that a very cheap and easy solution would be to widen the last bit of Eastern Lane from the Tesco roundabout to 3 lanes and to provide a slip road for the traffic wishing to join the A34 eastbound. There is plenty of room for this, and the middle lane could then be dedicated to M3 northbound and A272 traffic, and the third lane to southbound M3 traffic. It will be interesting to see what solution the Highways Agency comes up with after years of ignoring the problem. But with only £400,000 allocated, I fear that we will only see tinkering with traffic lights, which will do little to solve the problem. I note with amusement that Councillor Brian Collin has finally come up with a comment to say this is good news. But in the past, he has never supported my letters or responded to my emails either, admittedly on several different subjects. Very few of our councillors have seemed at all concerned, but those of us who work in the area know just how quickly traffic can build up and tail back into Wales Street. When this happens, it can take 20 minutes to reach the end of Eastern Lane. Those of us in the know drive up through the town, as it is usually a quicker alternative. Keith Webb.
The next letter is from David Selby, and it's titled Protest Against This Unnecessary Post. Sir, I note that Michael Mates, a contender for the job as Sheriff of Hampshire in November, has selected a running mate. This is one of the sillier acts of the coalition has copied from the USA. Firstly, it was suggested that it would be non-political, and now all the parties have nominated candidates. All the independent candidates are already at a disadvantage with regard to sending out a leaflet. Secondly, the main purpose was suggested as a way of saving money. On top of the £85,000 for sheriff, it looks as though there will be a full back office staff, as well as the deputy, a bill of at least £250,000 when accommodation is accounted for. Presumably, this comes out of the police budget before the sheriff starts looking for other economies. Thirdly, if he finds areas to save money, what does he communicate to the chief constable? Lay off investigating business fraud or benefit fraud? How far will this be influenced by which political party he or she represents? Fourthly, having just returned from Canada, where a commission is looking into corruption and the misuse of public funds, there could be the same temptation here in approving civilian contracts to take over part of current police work. In no way am I impugning the integrity of any candidates, but merely pointing out that this unnecessary post could be subject to dubious practices. That they have been elected does not guarantee integrity, as the MP's expenses scandal demonstrated. Already some cities have rejected elected mayors. Do we get the same opportunity with regard to the new sheriffs? I shall spoil my ballot paper in protest against this unnecessary post, which adds another layer of bureaucracy and cost to our already beleaguered police force. Who will join me in this mildest of protests? And that's from David Selby, West Hill Road, North, South Wanston.
The next letter comes from Douglas Patterson, who is chairman of Keep Hampshire Green, and it's entitled This Overinflated Subsidy System. Sir, the proposals for a massive wind-driven power station at Bullington Cross provoked an angry response at a public meeting in Sutton Scotney, not because the people of Hampshire are reactionary, but because many understand what is really going on here. Some well-intentioned people are under the illusion that wind turbines are symbols of our concern for the environment and future energy supply. However, We need facts and figures, not symbols, to solve these urgent problems. If Bullingdon were built, it would be one of the largest inland wind farms in the south. But it might supply, on a good day, half of 1% of the electricity of the fossil-fuelled power station at Didcot in Oxfordshire. Most days it would produce less than 0.5%, and many days nothing at all. The irony is that we would still need a Didcot running on standby for when the wind drops. It may blow, but the coal keeps burning. Eminent academics have been pointing out this problem for years. Electricity firms like EDF are well aware of the wind's unpredictable and feeble output. But wind turbines are the easiest way to access the overinflated subsidy system and avoid green fines. It pays EDF to build them, even in unsuitable places like Hampshire. Never forget, these are subsidy harvesting machines. This money, our money, would be better spent on researching energy conservation and predictable renewable solutions, such as those tidal ideas being developed on the Isle of Wight. 17 massive turbines stretching across the Hampshire landscape would not represent a rational investment of resources, but evidence of a futile sacrifice in the interests of big business. And that comes from Douglas Patterson.
And here is a letter from Phil Gagg, Fairfield Road, Full Flood, Winchester, with yet another thought on wind turbines, and is headed, "Wind Turbines More Efficient Than Cars." "Sir, I was pleased to learn, letters October the 4th, that Jocelyn Penbull is concerned about climate change. I cannot accept how he would tackle it, however. It is wrong to say wind turbines are inefficient. To express a car's efficiency, we say how many miles a car will travel, output, on a gallon of fuel, input. Wind turbines, once built, produce electricity, output, from no fuel whatsoever, input, making them infinitely efficient. The wind farm proposal says the turbines will be 30% efficient. If we were to apply this to cars, one carrying one passenger, 25%, for 1 hour in 24, 8.3% at half its cruising speed, 50%, is deemed 1% efficient. He is wrong to imply that with nuclear power we will not need wind turbines. If we decarbonise our energy supply, the demand for zero carbon electricity will be huge. We would need every facility for zero carbon electricity production ever proposed, wind power, wave, solar, etc., and put everything ever suggested to cut demand. The nuclear construction industry is in disarray. There is no agreement on the technology, and construction could take 20 years. Equally, decommissioning costs will make them prohibitively expensive. Finally, where will the new power stations go? Following disaster in Japan and in anticipation of the rise in sea levels, it will be suicidal to site nuclear facilities by the sea. Hinkley Point is close to the last known site of tsunami destruction in Britain. Only one current nuclear site is inland. Stable inland sites with a plentiful supply of water are badly needed. Bullingdon would tick all the boxes, but a nuclear facility would need to be at the Mitchell Dever end to allow for removal of spent fuel by rail. I suggest he launches a campaign to replace the proposed wind farm with a nuclear power station. Philip Gage."
This letter is from Jackie Mitchell and it's headed, "More Limping Than Springing." "Sir, I'd like to make a suggestion to Stagecoach to rename their service to Springvale from the Spring to the Pathetic Limp. The service is always late or non-existent, overcrowded and, above all, No apologies. It's from Jackie Mitchell, Pound Lane, Kingsworthy.
This letter comes from Chris White, who is attached to Indigo Public Affairs Limited. And he heads this letter, "This technology is not incineration." Sir, in a recent edition, you referred to the advanced conversion technology incinerator being proposed for Mitchell Dever Station. The technology proposed to be used by Clean Power Property Limited, that's CPPL, at Mitchell Dever, uses a combination of steam sterilisation, anaerobic digestion and advanced conversion to create a clean biogas which is suitable for power generation. CPPL's process recovers all available recyclable material, that's metals, plastics, glass, etc., in a form that is suitable for recycling and recovery elsewhere and has significant environmental benefits over conventional waste treatment. CPPL's technology cannot be regarded as incineration, and we would like to emphasise that including this term in your description is both misleading and incorrect. Chris White.
And this letter is from Patricia Elkington, County Organiser, Hampshire National Garden Scheme, Crawley, Winchester, and is headed, "After the Brickbats, a Bouquet for City's Floral Designers." Sir, Belgarum wrote, Chronicle, October the 18th, concerning adverse comments about the Winchester floral decorations, which had been described as substandard. This was entirely due to the unprecedented bad weather and, early in the summer, lack of the sunshine necessary for half-hardy plants. Then he wrote, "While there might not have been a great variety of flowers, the hanging baskets were particularly good later because the varieties and colours were limited. The pyramids by King Alfred looked magnificent. There is an old garden saying, if you have something that is effective, have a lot of it. In previous years, we have had a mad mixture of colours, including magenta, bright yellow, pink and scarlet in one container, which was not harmonious and did nothing to enhance the architecture of our ancient city. Congratulations and thanks to Winchester Business Improvement District. And please, may we have the same floral decoration design as next year. This year, the display was the best ever."
That's the end of the letters. If you wish to contact the Hampshire Chronicle, you can do so by telephoning 01962 860836. That's 01962 860836. Or you can email news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. Or you can write to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. Looking back, we begin with the news from 200 years ago. So thank you, Michael.
Well, it goes back to 1812. "Whether Bonaparte will or will not find good winter quarters and abundance of supplies in Moscow is a favourite subject of discussion in the newspapers. For though the buildings consist chiefly of small wooden houses, there are whole streets of stone and brick palaces roofed with iron, and the walls of these are so prodigiously thick that the late conflagration could scarcely spread through them." Yesterday afternoon, about 3, the inhabitants of Palace Yard, Westminster, were thrown into confusion in consequence of the Thames overflowing their houses, occasioned by the extremely high tide. The houses of the Speaker, Mr. Warren, Mr. Rickman, and several others were inundated, and the tide burst into Westminster Hall and at one time was so high as to cover the first arch of Westminster Bridge.
Now we move on to 1912. Before Winchester County Bench, Frederick Peterson pleaded guilty to begging. Constable Samway stated that at 2:45 on Sunday afternoon, he was on duty in plain clothes at Shawford and received complaints about the prisoner. On questioning him, he said he had called at houses to try and get a few coppers to help him back to the Isle of Wight, where he was trying to get into the workhouse infirmary until he received his old age pension. At the Mothers' Union annual conference, Canon Simpson was to speak on literature and amusements, but devoted his remarks entirely to the subject of literature. He said he was there to ask them to take their part in the formation of a great public opinion on the influence of pernicious literature throughout the length and breadth of the land.
Now, two pieces from 50 years ago, that's 1962. By unanimous vote, Hampshire Health Committee has come out in favour of the fluoridation of water supplies and will ask the County Council to press the Minister of Health to bring about its adoption. Lady Doris Blacker, East Meon, asked if it was true that fluoride could turn teeth brown and black, and was told it could happen with an overdose of fluoride, but raising the content of drinking water to a level of one part per million had been found to give the necessary protection. Different sections of the movement were represented on Saturday when blue uniforms filled Winchester Guildhall for the annual County Conference of Hampshire Girl Guides Association. A busy day included a morning of training sessions and early evening services in Winchester Cathedral and St Peter's Roman Catholic Church.
The next two pieces come from the year 1987, that's 25 years ago. Building the M3 on the line of the existing bypass would delay the opening by 3 years. The Department of Transport told this to the public inquiry, now in its fourth week. And they said that if a route west of St Catherine's Hill was adopted, another public inquiry would have to be held. Mr Peter Davis, M3 project manager, said the department's route for the Bar End to Compton section would be open in the spring of 1992, but routing the road on the existing bypass would delay it until 1995. Life in Hampshire is slowly returning to normal in the aftermath of the hurricane force winds, which left thousands without heating and lighting and devastated trees and buildings right across the south. The bill for damage will run into tens of millions of pounds, and the County Council alone spent £500,000 on its weekend clear-up operation.
Peter will now give us editorial comment.
Pastors have been a positive for the city. There would doubtless be two schools of thought about the success of the first year of Winchester's street pastors scheme. On the one hand, there would be those who would say if there were more police on the streets, there would be no need for them. Others might bemoan the drunkenness on the streets of the city centre on Friday and Saturday nights and wonder why, for a minority but still sizeable number of young people, they can only gauge whether they've had a good night out if they can't remember it. On the plus side, because street pastors have been good for the city, there will be few who could disagree that they have made the city centre a safer place. The pastors work to act as a calming influence, handing out blankets and water to those who appear overly drunk, even making phone calls and arranging taxis on their behalf. Since their introduction last year, there has been a big reduction in violent crime, say the police, and they've helped to drive down antisocial behaviour merely by their presence around and about. The pastors are another example of a band of volunteers giving up their time to help others. They should be thanked and supported for the work they do.
And Michael will give us first person.
Yes, by Rosemary McMullen, as usual. And it's called Don't Bank on This Elitist Idea. She says, I thought I'd had a time lapse of some kind, and it was April the 1st. There was a perfectly sane-looking man chatting to Philip and Holly about his new venture. The expression on the face of this morning's agony aunt Denise was a picture. How can this not be a joke? Fame Daddy is the latest sperm bank, where for the princely sum of £15,000 and rising, you can ensure you give birth to a child who may well follow in his famous but anonymous father's footsteps. Obviously, it would take time to build up a bank, so first comers may find theirs is not the only sprog bearing a strong resemblance to their chosen star. It might be rather fun to have a class full of boys answering a register with, "My name is Bond, James Bond." But do we want little clones of Lord Alan Sugar pointing their fingers and chorusing, "You're fired!" The mop-headed mayor of London might be a popular choice. Boris babes bounding all over Britain would certainly improve the mood of the nation, while Scottish would-be mums might go for the perseverance of Andrew Murray. "Love all," says Andy Murray. Personally, I'd happily welcome a gaggle of little Gareth Malones waving their tiny arms around and teaching the world to sing. I can't for the life of me understand why any of the top of their profession candidates for this anonymous fatherhood would go in for this. They don't need the money, nor should they dismiss the risk of being faced with brats holding out a begging bowl crying, "I need some more." If it is simply an ego trip, shame on you, gentlemen. Dan Richards, the chief executive of this venture, didn't even blink as he told me how a friend of his would prefer a superior father for her child than the man she said she loved and would stay with. She sounds to me to be too cold and calculating to be a good mother to any man's child. A natural donor for her should be John McEnroe. You cannot be serious, madam. Anyway, with a modicum of common sense, anyone with a modicum of common sense must realise that there would be no guarantee of the child turning out like its father. In too many cases, it would be a tragedy if it did. Top of the tree one moment and doling out your sperm at the bottom of the heap by the time the child reaches adulthood. Who do you think you are? Oh, rather not know, thanks. I'd rather regard my son as an A-lister, even if he weren't a success, because simply he's happy, healthy and a genuinely nice human. The same goes for my daughter. For couples coping with the pain of infertility and happy to use sperm from existing banks, this elitist idea must seem absolutely appalling.
We continue with further items of general news.
The first one is entitled "A Whole Lot of Money." A golf club near Winchester has raised a record-breaking amount for Parkinson's UK. Avington Park Golf Club presented the charity with £3,900 at the Itchen Valley Club. Jane Bellamy, pictured above in pink, captain of the ladies' team, said everyone at the club was thrilled because it was the most they had ever raised. Myra Clark, 80, of Hairstock, accepted the cheque on behalf of the charity, where she has worked for 23 years. Also pictured are men's captain Nick Culhane, left, and seniors captain Bill Harding.
Charity shops raided by burglars. Burglars have stolen hundreds of pounds in cash from two city centre charity shops. Intruders broke into Oxfam Books and Music and Cancer Research UK shops in Parchment Street overnight on Saturday, badly damaging both back doors. Laura Day, manager of Cancer Research UK shop, said, "They ripped my safe off the floor, stealing my entire Saturday takings of around £550. They broke the back door, which was deadbolted, with three bolts. I have no idea how much that will cost to replace. Saturday is our biggest day of the week for takings, and it was the biggest we had had for a while, because it followed the Stand Up for Cancer event on Channel 4 on Friday. I think whoever did this might have seen that and thought, we would have more money on the premises. Ingrid Clifford, Oxfam shop manager, said the burglars were unable to get into their safe, but took around £130 from the till and charity tins. She added, "It's such a petty mindless thing to do. We are lucky they could not find the key for the safe, but they certainly tried to because they ransacked the place." It was a week of mixed emotions at the bookshop after it made its highest ever sale, taking £250,000 for a first edition of Arthur Conan Doyle's Sign of the Four from the late 1800s. Miss Clifford said, "We all felt great after that, but now this has happened. But we go through every donation carefully, because you cannot always tell when you are going to look at something that is valuable. Sometimes it pays off." The book was sold online to a customer in Manchester.
Fund to help father of family killed in house fire. An appeal has been launched to raise funds to support a former Winchester doctor whose wife and five children were killed in a house fire. Dr. Abdul Shakur, pictured in here in the paper, who worked at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital until last year, lost his wife Saba Usmani and children Hira, who was 12, Sohab, who is 11, Munib, who is 9, Ravan, who is 6, Maheen, 3, in the blaze of their home in Essex last Monday. Now, the Princess Alexandra Hospital NHS Trust in Essex, where Dr. Shakur currently works, has launched a fund in bid to help him. Meanwhile, prayers were said at the Harlow Islamic Centre in the town where the family lived in memory of those who died and in a show of support for Dr. Shakur. Melanie Walker, the hospital's chief executive, expressed her condolences outside the multi-faith ceremony. She said, "All of us have been saddened by this tragedy, and as a close-knit hospital community, many of us know Dr. Shakur." Zia Rahman from the Islamic Centre said, "The community is deeply affected by this tragedy, but they have all come together to share their grief and sorrow and to help in any way they can. The aim of the fund is to support Dr. Shakur through a very difficult time," a hospital spokesman said. Dr. Sabah Usmani and her four eldest children all died shortly after the fire. Maheen lost her fight for life last week. Dr. Shakur has been transferred to the Broomfield Hospital in Chelmsford to be closer to her. Essex police initially treated this blaze as a suspected arson attack, but no trace of an accelerant has so far been found. Cash will be accepted at the hospital's general office and cheque should be made payable to PAHNHS Trust, with the reference Dr. Shakur 9H50. These will also be accepted.
Residents' trip down memory lane. Residents at a Winchester care home are taking a stroll down memory lane. St Catherine's View, which serves people with dementia, has a garden with purpose-designed paths, country-style gates, benches and water features to stimulate residents' memories. Now the new home, managed by Colton Care, has won gold for the Best Memory Garden at the New Homes Gardens Award. A cafe-style room opens out with alfresco tables and chairs, and residents can even walk to a garden bus stop to reminisce about past routines and journeys. Colton Care Managing Director Ian Hudson said, "The aim of the garden is to create a safe environment with a pleasant, stimulating feel, and our designers have planned every detail with dementia care in mind. The awards recognise excellence in the regeneration of gardens and landscapes around new and renovated buildings. The £8 million home in Stanmore Lane was opened in May 2012 and employs 80 members of staff.
£300,000 for woman left wheelchair bound. Latest interim award will help fund home improvements. A woman left wheelchair bound by a head-on road collision has moved a step closer to securing her dream home after being awarded £300,000 by the High Court. Janice Crispin, 51, is tetraplegic and uses an electric wheelchair after being seriously injured in the head-on collision with an elderly motorist on the A303 near Exeter in June 2010. Mrs. Crispin, a former HR manager, has already received £1.275 million in interim payments from the driver's insurance company pending final assessment of her full damages award. And the judge added another £300,000 despite fierce objections from the insurers. She will use the money to upgrade a recently purchased £835,000 home in Christchurch Road, Winchester, to adapt it to her needs. The house currently stands empty after work stalled due to lack of funds, but Judge Mr Justice Stuart Smith opened the way for her to turn her dreams into reality. However, the judge said that even interim payments totalling £1.575 million would probably only represent a relatively small proportion of her eventual payout. The insurance company had argued that the house was too expensive and fundamentally unsuitable for Mrs. Crispin's needs. It values her claim at more than £6 million, but Mrs. Crispin's legal team say that it's worth much more than that. Her lawyers claim she's owed more than £1.3 million for accommodation, £300,000 for transport, almost £150,000 for special technology, and more than £600,000 for the increased cost of holidays. But the judge emphasised that it will eventually be for a court to decide whether the sums she is spending on her new home are reasonable. A High Court assessment of her damages is expected to take place before Christmas. As well as challenging her expenditure on her new home, the insurance company also says that some of her other claims are excessive. It follows a £250,000 interim payout she received from the High Court last November. At that hearing, her counsel, Paul Dean, told Mr. Justice Haddon Cave that Mrs. Crispin and her partner, who suffered a broken pelvis in the crash, were living in a modern bungalow in the middle of nowhere, in Crawley, and added, she doesn't want to be there.
The next piece has headlines in three-quarter-inch print saying, Lib Dem chief rakes in more than Prime Minister. And then under the subheading it says, it's up to voters to decide if I'm worth it, says Councillor Keith Howes. Hampshire's highest paid county councillor has a bigger pay packet than MPs, the Hampshire Chronicle can reveal. Liberal Democrat Keith Howes was paid almost £67,500 by holding five public paid positions in 2011 and 12. His role as Eastleigh Council boss is his main job, but he's also opposition leader on the county council and sits on three other bodies. Mr. Howes, who's 47, had more paid roles, or hats, as it's called, than any other Hampshire County Councillor, according to new figures compiled by anti-council tax group Is It Fair? The scale of his allowances have been brought fresh protest from the group outraged at the way some elected councillors are professional politicians. But Mr. Howes, a full-time politician, said it was for voters to decide at the ballot box if he was worth it. He said, in Eastleigh, I have kept council tax down, I've protected services, improved facilities and followed up on casework. In Hampshire, I have kept the administration to account. payments to 78 county councillors now cost taxpayers £1.9 million a year. As well as being paid £12,000 just for being members of the county council, most claim multiple allowances for also sitting on district councils, the fire and police authorities and other bodies, including New Forest National Park Authority. And 40 county councillors have joined the generous pension scheme enjoyed by local government staff, guaranteeing them an income based on the allowances which they are paid as councillors. In total, the county council alone forked out £1.4 million for councillor allowances and expenses in 2011 and 12. The county froze councillor allowances for the third year running to save money, but has not reduced them despite cutting services and jobs. Peter Fleming, chairman of the Local Government Association, defended allowances, saying, "Providing financial support ensures that local democracy does not become the preserve of the privileged few who can afford to give their time for free."
A £7.2 million lottery grant fixes it for charity. A Winchester-based charity is about to go national thanks to £7.2 million of lottery funding. The Public Service Broadcasting Trust, from its offices in St Thomas's Street, uses the media to mobilise people into taking positive social action. After a year-long hiatus, it has relaunched Fixers, which helps youths across the South to tackle issues close to their hearts. Their achievements are then highlighted within ITV Regional News. Peter Ainsworth, chairman at the Big Lottery Fund, said, "By providing a platform to highlight their voluntary work and many achievements, Fixers demonstrates the positive contribution thousands of committed young people are making at a local level and challenges negative stereotypes." The relaunch took place on ITV earlier this month with items in Meridian Tonight. The event was marked by a reception in the Trust's offices attended by city and county councillors, youth charities, broadcasters and a number of young people involved in Fixers. Winchester and Chandler's Ford MP Steve Brine, who will host a parliamentary reception for Fixers in Westminster next year, said, "Fixers is a real success story that is offering something unique to young people around the country. I am very proud that it has its roots in Winchester."
Church group opposes women bishops. A Winchester church is hosting the launch of a local breakaway group over plans for Anglican women bishops. The General Synod, the Church of England's ruling body, is due to vote on the ordination of women bishops next month. Just days before the crunch vote, Holy Trinity Church in Upper Brook Street is setting up a Winchester diocesan branch of the Mission Society of St Winifred and St Hilda on Saturday, November the 16th, with the blessing of the Bishop of Richborough. Created by traditional Anglo-Catholic bishops about 18 months ago, the Society aims to provide a place within the Church of England for clergy and lay people opposed to women bishops. The Society describes itself as led by bishops loyal to the Church of England and her Catholic heritage. Holy Trinity, which has a congregation of between 40 and 50, is also part of the Forward in Faith, a movement opposed to the ordination of women priests. Father Malcolm Jones, parish priest of Holy Trinity, said the ordination of women was not according to tradition or theology contained in the Bible. Asked if the Society recognised Pope Benedict or the Archbishop of Canterbury as its head, he said it was more complicated. Plans for the launch include Mass at 12 noon, followed by a 2 p.m. meeting and prayers at 5 p.m.
Conference spotlights childhood development. The first public viewing of a groundbreaking document aiming to influence childhood development in the UK will take place in Winchester. The Launch Conference for Early Childhood Action, ECA, will be held at Winchester University this weekend, when speakers will challenge the fashionable culture which forces children to grow up too soon. Unhurried Pathways Towards a New Paradigm for Early Childhood, the document, will feature experts such as Dr. Penelope Leach, author of Your Baby and Child, Emeritus Professor of Child Psychology and Psychobiology, Colwyn Trevathan and Sue Palmer, author of Toxic Childhood. Dr. Richard House, senior lecturer at the university, said, "The key aspect of ECA's approach is to support early years practitioners in becoming autonomous professionals who are sensitive and attuned to the unique needs of each child. It also aims to highlight the social, cultural and political context of practitioners' work and to put children's well-being before political ideology or the latest policy-making fashions." The keynote address will be given by the acclaimed Professor of Physiology, Baroness Susan Greenfield. Unhurried Pathways will take place on Saturday, October the 27th at The Stripe, University of Winchester, Sparkford Road. And for further details, visit ECA website.
Keeping it in the family for Test Valley's 50th. A special assembly was the finale to celebrations marking 50 years of Test Valley School, Stockbridge, looking to the past and the future. The gathering was told that current year 7 pupils had created a time capsule containing letters and items which will be opened in 2061. Also attending were the winners of a special competition to find the family with the most pupils, past and present. The Simmons clan came up with 21 members and a 47-year link with the school. They included Andy Simmons, who attended the school between 1965 and 1969, his brothers Peter, Stuart, Philip and Anthony, and sisters Carol, Christine and Susan. The family offspring included Andy's son and daughter, Dustin and Tara, Carol's son and two daughters, Tim, Anna Marie and Sarah Jane, Christine's two daughters, Cheryl and Emma, Stuart's son and two daughters, Alexander, Lauren and Katie, and Susan's son and daughter, Terry and Samantha. And finally, Kylie Palmer, who is a current pupil at the school and is Sarah Jane's son. Not all of them could attend the ceremony, but Andy was accompanied by Carol, Susan, Dustin, Tara, Sarah Jane, Samantha and Kylie. Andy, 58, who was at the school when it was called the Stockbridge County Secondary, spoke about life when he was a pupil. He said, "I recall one day being summoned to the headmaster's office and being threatened with the cane. I and a mate, Gary Blake, had missed the school bus several times over a matter of weeks. Our parents didn't have a car in those days, and it was a 5-mile walk to Stockbridge from Mottisfont, so we didn't bother going to school." The time capsule launch followed a series of 50th birthday events, including a grand quiz and a reunion of pupils. The Test Valley's head teacher, Louise Hiscock, said, "It was wonderful to welcome the Simmons family back to Test Valley School and share this special occasion with them. The competition highlighted just how many families have attended our school through more than one generation and maintained such strong links with us." Chairman of the school governors, John Smith, presented Andy with a hamper for the Simmons family taking part in the competition. And after the event, the hamper was given to Andy's parents, Dennis and Iris Simmons. The Simmons family were given a guided tour of the school to see how it had changed since they were pupils.
Residents evacuated after homes flooded. Winchester residents were forced to evacuate their homes after a thunderstorm last week. ground floor residents of a block of flats in Hyde Street had to leave when the homes were flooded at around 6:30 p.m. last Wednesday. Sovereign Kingfisher Housing Association owns the flats and paid for some of the tenants to stay at the Holiday Inn in Mournhill overnight. Four flats were evacuated, with some tenants choosing to stay with friends. One resident, who asked not to be named, said it was a terrifying experience. He said, "I'm told a great load of water came down Victoria Lane. I didn't really know what the problem was until we were told not to open the back door because the water was 4 foot high. It was horrible and very scary, and I thought I would be safer if I went to stay with a friend." The spokesman for Sovereign Kingfisher said, "Our initial concern was for the safety and welfare of our residents, and we are arranging accommodation until their homes are habitable again. Our surveyor visited the site to assess the extent of the damage. We organised for gullies to be cleared and for the basement and lift shaft to have the water pumped out in order to assess whether the lift and other electrics were affected by the flood. We understand there was no sitting water in the flats, and we brought in dehumidifiers to dry them out. One appliance and one special equipment unit from Winchester Fire Station used a pump to remove the water. Of the four homes evacuated, it is understood that two families are still in hotels while the other two occupiers have returned. But a resident who asked not to be named said they could remain in hotels for several more weeks. She said, "We're getting different messages at the moment, but it could be 5 weeks before we can go back."
Row over travellers' sites. Winchester planners have given temporary planning permission for two families to stay at a travelling showman site in the Meon Valley, despite pleas from villagers. Several travelling families have been based at the unauthorised site near Shedfield since 1992, leaving in the summer for the fairground circuit and returning in the autumn. Of the seven pitches on the nurseries in Botley Road, three have had temporary planning permissions, but all expired this year. Jess Bond of Shedfield Parish Council said, "The continuing encroachment onto the countryside is wholly inappropriate. How can it be right for City Council to continue to endorse the actions of people ignoring the planning rules whilst applying the rules so vigorously to everyone else? The City Council is not fulfilling its obligations and the people of Shedfield are paying a high price." The committee heard that the council is legally obliged to find pitches for gypsies, travellers and travelling show people. A strategy is being worked up with research into demand, but the strategy is not expected to be finished in 2015. The planning officers were recommending that temporary permission be granted to John Whittle and Patrick Burton and their families until October 2015. That would allow time for the planning policies to be clarified. One complicating factor was the travelling showman site at Mitchell-Dever, which got planning permission but is not being lived in by showmen. The committee heard that the families at Shedfield had fallen out with those at Mitchell-Dever and so had never relocated there. Neil Marsh, planning and enforcement manager, said the council was challenging a planning inspector's decision earlier this year that blocked planners taking action to ensure the Mitchell-Dever site is only lived in by travelling showmen. A hearing is due at the High Court in January 2013.
Mobile library changes implemented. Hampshire County Council is introducing changes to some mobile library routes this week with the launch of a new timetable detailing hundreds of mobile library stops across the county. The mobile library service will make 343 stops around Hampshire, mainly on a four-weekly and weekly basis. The new revised timetable includes a change from four-weekly to fortnightly visits for Broughton and King Sunborn in the Test Valley, and the length of some existing stops in Test Valley will increase to cater for more customer visits. The new service follows a public consultation held over the summer, with feedback and comments used to help ensure the service reaches as many people as possible and uses resources in the most efficient and effective way. Executive Member for Culture and Recreation, Councillor Keith Chapman, said, "Almost every community in Hampshire will continue to receive one mobile library visit per community by one of the four mobile library vehicles. We will be working with town and parish councils to publicise the stops in local towns and villages so more people are encouraged to step aboard and make use of the service. If people wish to use a mobile library but are unable to get to the new stop, then a friend, family member or neighbour willing to visit the library or mobile library on their behalf can be registered as a good neighbour and borrow books for them. All the new routines are now available online at hants.gov.uk/mobile-libraries or by calling 0845 603 5631. Visitors to the website can simply enter their postcode to find their nearest stop on the map."
"They can't have it both ways," says Campaigner. Environmental campaigners have ridiculed the government for declaring that green spaces are safe from development. Community Secretary Eric Pickles dismissed fears of an urban sprawl under controversial planning reforms. But his stance provoked anger from the leader of the Save Barton Farm Group. Gavin Blackman, chairman, said he either hasn't read the letter he signed the other week or he is being very economical with the truth. He is contradicting himself with what he's saying and what he's doing. It's very hypocritical. He should practice what he preaches and not try to have it both ways. The Hampshire branch of the Campaign for the Protection of Rural England has said it is horrified at the proposed relaxation of planning rules, claiming cherished green spaces are under threat. Mr. Pickles said, "Just as we want to change things, we also want to protect the good things, especially the environment. So, we've introduced a new protection for valuable green spaces and have given councils new powers to stop unwanted garden grabbing. Protecting the character of the countryside is stamped deep into the heart of conservatism. And I want to be absolutely clear. The Green Belt plays a vital role in stopping urban sprawl, and we will protect it."
Looking northwards in boundary change, Alsfords could be set adrift from Winchester. The Alsford area could be severed from the Winchester constituency and lumped with North East Hampshire under proposals by the Boundary Commission. The Alsfords ward, which includes New Alsford and Old Alsford, Gundleton and Byton, could be sliced away to join a new North East Hampshire and Alton constituency that stretches as far north as Yateley, Hartley, Wintney, Fleet and Hook, close to the Berkshire border. The Winchester constituency would also lose Chandos Ford, which joined it in 2010. The Meon Valley constituency would also disappear. The new Winchester boundary would be similar to the boundary pre-2010, when it was identical to the City Council district. Steve Bryan, MP for Winchester and Chandos Ford, said, "When I first saw this proposal, I thought it was some kind of April Fool joke. It is so daft. Alsford looks to Winchester and has always been part of Winchester when it comes to electing an MP, let alone the strong historical and family links we share. My constituents in the town and surrounding villages will be bemused by this, as they share no sense of community with Fleet and Yateley. The proposal suits no one, no one I can think of, and I am aware already of robust representations being made to the Boundary Commission by local people to stop this silly idea in its tracks. The deadline for feedback is December the 10th.
Rose-tinted memories of Southampton's boat train. Southampton in the 1950s and steam locomotives and the lost romance of travel are a rich combination when it comes to nostalgia. Add to this rightful mix a Winchester clergyman born in the first year of the last century who, to put it mildly, had an obsession with trains and railways, and the scene is set for a feast of rose-tinted memories. The official biography of Canon Roger Lloyd does not do him justice, as his abiding love of trains is mentioned only briefly as he pursued the theme of railways. In 1951, Canon Lloyd published a book entitled The Fascination of Railways, which encapsulated everything he enjoyed about his hobby. He writes, "The curious but intense pleasure that is given to many people by the watching and study of railway trains, their engines, and the detail of their organisation is both an art and a mystery. It is an art because the pleasure to be had is exactly proportionate to the informed enthusiasm one puts into it. It is a mystery because, try as one will, it is impossible to explain to others exactly in which the pleasure consists." Perhaps the most charming section of the book, now long out of print, is a description of a journey on the 9 p.m. Channel Islands boat train from Waterloo to Southampton Docks. "The whole train has a pleasantly continental and holiday air," writes the author. "There is a dining car, but not many have dinner. The hour is too late, and besides, the experienced traveller to Le Havre or St. Peterport knows well that the railway boat trains have an excellent restaurant where they save a far more ample and varied supper before the boat sails than can be had anywhere ashore. At 9 o'clock, out into the darkness and round the double curve into Vauxhall, the train runs behind its Lord Nelson or King Arthur engine, and by Clapham it is worked up to full speed. The train continues before stopping at Basingstoke and Winchester to pick up more passengers. When we come to St. Denis, the train slackens speed. For me, the signal to find a corridor window looking out onto the right-hand side and to lean out the rest of the way," says the canon. "We slow down steadily until Southampton Terminus Station comes in sight, where a tank engine, its shunting rolling stock ready for the morning trains, and it seems almost as if we were going to enter it, but at the last moment we lurch to the left and slowly glide round the outside of it. By now we are crawling at no more than a walking pace, and we go across what is in daytime a very busy road, our passage being guarded by a man with a bell and a red lamp. Then the train passes through the dock gate and grinds round a left-hand curve so sharp that one wonders so large an engine can negotiate it. In less than a minute more, we pass out of the darkness and into the glaring metallic light of the dock shed, where at last we come to rest. By now, the clock overhead reads 10:50 p.m., another hour before the steamer sets sail. The author says, some, the dullards, go straight to bed. Others make for the dining room and have supper, which is my own practice. At last we gather way and begin to move down Southampton Water, past the lights of the Netley Shore Road and the dark mass of the hospital just beyond, past a Union Castle ship tied up in the river, past a dredger working noisily to keep the channel clear for the two queens, past various dark ships which cause one to speculate on them, why and wherefore, and past the great oil installation and the seaplane base. It takes about 45 minutes to come into the Solent and move towards the Needles Lighthouse, and it is at that point I generally call it a day and make for bed.
Indoor and outdoor sports centres for city. Summit hears ideas for sports provision. Winchester could benefit from having two specialist sports centres at River Park and Bar End. Now, that was the view of the city sports clubs at a city council summit to explore the future of sport in Winchester. Around 80 people from 50 clubs across 30 sports were represented at the meeting at the Guildhall last week. They were divided into teams and given specific characters to examine, like 12-year-old Ben, 23-year-old young professional Chloe and 48-year-old middle-class professional Philip, and asked to suggest what sporting provision each would need. But the debate quickly came back to the long-running issue of River Park Leisure Centre and whether it should be repaired or replaced with a new facility at Bar End. The council has still not decided which option is more financially viable, but club representatives said a new indoor sports centre could complement River Park if the latter was used for outdoor sports. Michaela McCallum of Winchester and District Athletic Club said, "You could take things out of River Park and have it as an outdoor centre, and then have another facility at Bar End for indoor sports. Bar End has massive potential for success." Sarah Radburn, chairman of Winchester Netball Club, said, "If you put a centre of excellence at Bar End, it would be right by the motorway with parking facilities already there. You could attract international sport to the area, and that is very, very doable." Eddie Owusa of Winchester City Basketball Club added, "As a venue, River Park has a lot of potential. The facilities are currently substandard, but in terms of size, a lot can be held there. It does need to be refurbished, but it could become a one-stop shop for the area." However, the Gordon Road Centre came under heavy criticism. Julie Passingham, a County Council swimming coach, said, "I teach there every day and I see what goes on, and I can see where it's cracking up and falling apart. It's not nice to teach at, let alone swim there." Other ideas suggested for the future of Winchester sport included taster days for young children to explore several sports and for older people and parents to try their hand at coaching. Earlier at the meeting, the council celebrated the effect of the Paralympics and Olympics on the city, with 80,000 people involved in the events over 5 months. The meeting heard 10% of medals won in both games were by Hampshire athletes, while the county also had the most athletes in the Team GB Olympic squad.
St Swithin's hosts Leadership Forum. Over 200 girls from schools across the south attended a leadership conference at St Swithin's School, Winchester. Organised by the Girls' School Association, the event examined the skills and characteristics that constitute leadership, in particular hearing how 20 prominent female leaders have made their way in the world. Girls were also asked to consider how their own experiences have shaped their views on leadership. The conference was opened by Dame Helen Gauche, who is Director General of the National Trust for Places of Historic Interest or Natural Beauty, and that followed 30 years of her work as a high-profile role in the government. Delegates had an opportunity to listen, learn and debate, eventually deciding on the leadership traits which most matched their personality and which proved most effective in the real world. Sessions were taken through the day by leading women in the fields of law, medicine, the charitable section, the armed forces, public service, police, environmental health, marketing, PR, corporate communications, sport and leisure, and entrepreneurship. Jane Gandhi, head of St Swithin, said, "I hope today's conference has opened minds to the reality of effective leadership. Successful leaders are far less brash and more subtle than media would sometimes have us believe." Jemima Sang, a pupil of age 14, said, "I was really motivated by the speakers and particularly by Lynn Owens, Chief Constable of Surrey Police. She and the others opened my eyes to the leadership opportunities now available to women in historically male-dominated professions."
First of police stations to be sold. Stockbridge and Twyford police stations are to be put on the market later this month. Hampshire Police plans to sell several stations and has announced that Stockbridge, along with Twyford and Old Basing near Basingstoke, are the first to go. The station in Stockbridge High Street has been closed to the public for some time, and police officers moved to a police station police office at Stockbridge Fire Station in June this year. Following a review of the estate in September this year, Hampshire Police Authority approved revised plans for the building its officers will operate from in the future. The force is attempting to save £50 million by 2015. The Alsford station on Station Road is also set to be sold, with the officers moving to the fire station on Pound Hill. Hampshire Police said the aim is to promote efficient working and provide modern, appropriate facilities to fit the current and future policing needs and enable officers and staff to provide the best possible service to the public whilst achieving value for money. The police buildings that are no longer needed by the force will be offered for sale over the coming months and years. A police spokeswoman said that no building will be removed from its estate until a suitable alternative location is found, and in most cases, the police stations that are being sold have not been open to the public for a long period of time. The capital raised from the sale of the buildings will go towards making the estate development programme, which includes a new police headquarters, police campus, four new police investigating centres and an extensive refurbishment programme, cost neutral. Anyone interested in purchasing any of the properties should contact Lambert Smith Hampton estate agents on 023 8033 0041.
Police cracking down on fatal four driving habits. Traffic police are cracking down on the fatal four bad driving habits that lead to deadly crashes on the South's roads. Major roads around Hampshire and the Isle of Wight are being targeted by officers to clamp down on offences such as using mobile phones while driving, not wearing seatbelts, and speeding. Despite an overall downward trend in accidents resulting in death or serious injury, the summer months saw a spike in numbers, particularly on the Isle of Wight, where five people died, prompting a response by police. The operation has begun and will run for an initial 6 months. Chief Inspector Andy Bottomley said, "We take a risk every time we get into our car, and the less responsible you are when driving, the greater that risk becomes. We're in a position where lives are being lost or heavily impacted by collisions, which could be prevented by a bit of common sense and consideration. The aim of this crackdown is to really hammer home the risks that bad driving practice carries with it and to try to change the attitudes of those driving poorly. You may pass your test as a teenager and never do it again, so there's scope to get into bad habits, and these are what cause collisions. Anyone found not wearing seatbelts will receive fixed penalty tickets, and those using mobile phones or other devices or speeding could face a fine or the courts. Drink drivers will be arrested and their car impounded while they are in custody."
Tower Arts Ron dies aged 93. Ron James, the man who opened the Tower Arts Centre in Winchester, has died aged 93 after a short illness. Mr. James, whose photograph appears with this article, was the county drama advisor when, in 1969, he saw the potential of the redundant water reservoir by King's School. The tower was initially only used for schools drama, but evolved into a general arts centre until the county council withdrew funding in 2007 when the Discovery Centre reopened. It is now part of King's School. Mr. James, a father of two, who lived in Sarum Road, Winchester, is survived by his wife Mavis. His funeral was held last Friday at St. Luke's Church in Stanmore.
Tree to be felled. A mature cedar tree in a Winchester suburb has been given a death sentence by city councillors. The planning committee has approved a plan by John Parker to cut down the tree in Stockers Avenue, Tegdown. There were several letters of objection and also from ward councillor Eileen Berry, who said the tree, believed to be 100 years old, was in good condition. but a report to the committee said it was only 3 or 4 metres from two houses and the branches were beginning to drop. The council acknowledged that the loss will affect the visual amenity of the area.
And that concludes the extracts for this week. Thank you to our editors, David and Janet Farthing. Thanks to our copying and dispatch and tape preparation teams. And thanks to our readers, Michael Wyard.
Goodbye.
Lynn Parker.
Goodbye.
And Peter Lydiard.
Goodbye.
And from me, Vara Williams. Goodbye, and do have a good week. Please post your memory sticks back as soon as possible in the yellow wallet. And when you put your label inside, please make sure that the cord attached to the memory stick is fully inside the wallet as well. Thank you.